From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. When Jon Kabat-Zinn founded the Stress Reduction Clinic at the University of Massachusetts, the use of meditation to control stress was considered a novel idea. Today, mindfulness-based stress reduction techniques have gone mainstream, appearing in hospitals, schools, and even military settings. Kabat-Zinn joins us to talk about his latest book, Mindfulness for Beginners, Reclaiming the Present Moment. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. And in this Forum Hour, we welcome Jon Kabat-Zinn, Professor of Medicine Emeritus and Founding Director of the Stress Reduction Clinic and Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Health, Care, and Society at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. A student of Zen and a founding member of the Cambridge Zen Center, he's the author of Full Catastrophe Living, Wherever You Go, There You Are, and Coming to Our Senses. And his most recent book is Mindfulness for Beginners, Reclaiming the Present Moment. And he joins us in studio for this hour. And good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, Mike.
Well, let's talk about mindfulness first, because it's become almost a part of the general lexicon and yet widely used, maybe even a little promiscuously used, goes back particularly to associations with Buddhism. But when you talk about mindfulness, you're talking about meditation, you're talking about thinking. What else are you talking about?
Well, actually, I'm not talking so much about thinking, although in order to talk,
well, non-thinking, we have thinking.
Non-thinking either, but gets complicated right from the beginning. But it's actually very simple. Meditation is really about paying attention. And mindfulness is a particular way of paying attention that is on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. And while that's easy to say, it turns out it's not so easy to do. And what arises when you pay attention on purpose in the present moment, which is the only moment we ever have to live or to experience or to feel or to think, when we pay attention in that way, what arises is awareness. And awareness is kind of like a very camouflaged, hidden dimension of our human repertoire. So thinking gets a lot of airtime and training in school. Awareness gets almost no intimacy or familiarization. And what mindfulness is a cultivating of a greater balance between awareness and all the other aspects of a human life lived in the body and thoughts and emotions and relationships.
And as you suggest, the opposite of that, it would be mindlessness.
Well, exactly. I mean, you'd be out to lunch, so to speak, all the time, zoning along on autopilot, more in the future and in the past than in the present moment. And if you sum that over a whole life, you might miss what's most beautiful and most precious about your own experience.
You talk, in fact, about Thich Nhat Hanh and talk about how things like anger and self-absorption can become habits and in some ways the synaptic habits that we have in our neural pathways or our nervous system in general need to be open like a cage. I think that's the metaphor in order to become more self-aware.
Well,
so we're locked into our thinking.
We do create these highly conditioned patterns of behavior, and then we suffer because of them. And they also function as lenses through which we see reality and understand our relationships and judge other people or judge ourselves, very often harshly and unfairly. And if you sum that again over days, weeks, months, and years, we're really missing some profound elements of our own possibilities and being, one of which is just feeling comfortable in your own skin, feeling happy, also feeling creative and tapping into imagination. And ultimately, I would say mindfulness is really about the quality of our relationships. So it's about relationality. And a good place to start is with the body. I mean, a lot of us have very strange relationship with our bodies and changes, of course, over the years. But, you know, if you start to bring attention to the relationship with the body, to the actual sensations that we experience in different parts of the body, especially when they're sometimes unpleasant or really even painful, we can learn that there are a lot of different degrees of freedom that we have that we don't know about that can now allow us to actually accommodate to different kinds of very stressful and difficult situations and then navigate through them in ways that are profoundly satisfying.
Well, that gets us right to meditation, which you make a strong case for as far as reducing stress. And actually, even beyond that, you talk about meditation as an act of love and benevolence and kindness and, well,
it's
toward
true,
oneself as well as others.
I do say that.
But also, you call it a brave gesture. And you say that perhaps the greatest benefit is the stress reduction.
Well, if you
that was
understand,
a big sigh, John.
Yes, there's a lot here. To unpack. So, you know, I run or founded a stress reduction clinic. And the idea of that was to actually invite people who were falling through the cracks of the healthcare system. And this is back when it started in 1979, falling through the cracks of the healthcare system and challenging them to see if there wasn't something they could do for themselves that no one on the planet, including their physicians and surgeons or clergy or whatever, could do for them. And that is by cultivating this capacity to actually drop in on one's own self and the full repertoire we have for learning, growing, healing, and transformation through paying attention and the cultivation of this kind of awareness. So stress reduction is kind of a misnomer in the sense that stress is part of life, and we're not trying to reduce it so much as we are to transform our relationship to it so that it doesn't wind up destroying us. And that is an art. It's a life skill akin to the martial art of Aikido, where you basically blend with whatever's coming at you in a way that cultivates the greatest non-harming and that allows you to actually move beyond impediments and obstacles. And because stress is something that's going to be with us, you know, till the day we
stress
die.
Stress is a part of life.
How we handle it, though, yeah, makes an enormous difference.
Well, I think a lot of the ways of handling it seem to do with things that we've already mentioned, mindfulness and self-forgiveness.
And alcohol and cigarettes and anger and
well,
spouse abuse.
Those are the ways that that people deal with stress, unfortunately, all too often that plague our society. But there's a sense of just the kind of chattering and bad habits, the habitual that you fall into as a way of relieving stress.
Yeah. I wouldn't even call them bad habits. I just think there are certain kind of unconscious conditioning that when we start to pay attention in this way, the first thing people recognize is, holy cow, I had no idea that my mind was just churning out thoughts like a waterfall, and that most of it, when I start to pay attention to it, is completely unreliable, inaccurate, but I wind up believing a great deal of it, acting on it, and that colors all my relationships, including with myself, my future, my family, my work, my, you know, everything I love, nature. And that coloration can shift in an instant if you actually show up in the present moment. So this is not about meditate for 50 years and you'll be a more relaxed guy. This is about right in this moment, can you live this moment as if your life actually depended on it?
Well, if you meditate for 50 years, you probably will be a more relaxed guy. But you, at one point in the book, you say, thinking in the service of awareness is heaven, the absence is hell. It's a new concept of heaven and hell.
I mean, it's not new. I mean, that's kind of
well, it goes back to Buddha, I suppose, in many ways,
and the Zen tradition. Yeah. I think that that what I'm trying to say in this book, Mindfulness for Beginners, is that a lot of our ideas about meditation are actually impediments to understanding and living what it's really about, which is a challenge to embody the life that we're already living, not to improve it, change it, reconstruct it, but to actually be present for it. It turns out this is just about the hardest thing in the world for us human beings to do.
Yeah, you point that out in your book, and I immediately had a reaction and said, I think parenting is maybe harder.
Yeah, and mindful parenting.
But you also say it's playful and should be playful.
Exactly. Well, the bottom line, if we were, you know, because we're not going to be here forever, the bottom line, I would say, is that to begin to notice how much of our experience we take personally when it's actually not personal. And if we could bring a greater sense of humor to moments where we tend to contract and seize up and the personal pronouns arise, I, me, and mine, and we get really tight under the collar. And if we could bring a more playful sense of humor to it, we would see right away that we create and compound an awful lot of unnecessary suffering.
talking with Jon Kabat-Zinn, and his new book is Mindfulness for Beginners. It takes a lot of motivation, though, to do that kind of meditation that you're talking about, to be within the present, to be within it without attachment and without identification.
Well, that's why I call it a love affair. I mean, if there's the motivation, it's the motivation to not miss our lives. And I think everybody has that motivation already. It's kind of like our default mode. But we've gotten so seduced into a shift in the default mode to self-distraction, where we're like always someplace else, scheming, thinking about the future, worrying about the future, remembering how great the past was or how horrible the past was, that the present moment, which is the only one we're ever in and alive in, gets incredibly squeezed. And if we can learn to re-inhabit it, to rehabilitate the present moment, then that comes with an enormous amount of potential that you don't get from books, you don't get from trying to be like somebody else, whether it's, you know, your favorite spiritual hero of the moment, but actually being yourself and not trying to attain some specialized state, you know, usually imaginary, such as your idea of enlightenment or, transcendence or anything like that, but to actually recognize that the quality that we call awareness has all of these different properties already built right into it and that we just don't know how to live inside it.
You're talking about authenticity, a kind of existential authenticity, aren't you?
I would say so,
sure. And what T.S. Eliot called the now that is always now.
Yeah, and T.S. Eliot really understood this from the inside, I think in part because he suffered so tremendously in his relationships. But he put two lines.
Mainly with his wife, Vivian. But I mean, when you talk about suffering, though, you're talking about something that, as you say, goes back to the Stone Age. I mean, it's almost as if it's in our DNA to suffer, really.
Well, exactly. And so is awareness in our DNA. Otherwise, how would we have it?
I'm interested in your response to something in Scientific American. There's a blog by an author by the name of John Horgan, and here's what he says. He says, meditation reportedly reduces stress, anxiety, and depression, but it has been linked to increased negative emotions too. Some studies indicate that meditation makes you hypersensitive to external stimuli. Others reveal the opposite effect. Brain scans do not yield consistent results either. For every report of heightened neural activity in the frontal cortex and decreased activity in the left parietal lobe, there exists a contrary result.
Hmm. That's a little bit unfair, but not totally unfair. The science of meditation and contemplative inquiry is in its infancy. I mean,
but I must tell you, I accepted prima facie the idea that meditation, going back to TM and all these kinds of things, really did help reduce stress. And here's somebody who throws
us. But when you understand evidence, and of course, I have a PhD in molecular biology from MIT with a Nobel laureate. So, you know, I swim in those waters. And when you are born into and understand science and, you know, what it's really about, it is about evidence and it's about discernment and really being critical about the level of evidence to support something. So there's a way in which, yes, of course, we're so much in the early years of meditation, even if you count it as 30 years of meditation research, that a lot of the findings are still tentative. We know almost nothing about the brain. In fact, the brain, which has something like, 200 or 400 billion neurons, is only half of the brain. There are another kind of cell in the brain called glial cells that are also at the same number as the neurons. No one even knows what they're doing there. So yes, it's true. There are a lot of very exciting and interesting findings in meditation research now that show not just changes in activity in the brain, in the frontal cortex, in regions that involve regulating emotions, particularly under stress. And they're all very promising, and he's wrong. I mean, they mostly point in the same direction.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've had programs on some of the studies that have been done in prisons, for example. Your own study I know about in Worcester, Massachusetts with inner city. James Gordon from Harvard has been on here talking about what he's done in Bosnia and Palestine and really throughout the world. And there does seem to definitely be the data.
The vector is definitely moving in that direction. So that's why I'm saying what he's saying in Scientific American is not exactly fair. There are studies now coming out of Mass General, Sarah Lazar's lab and Britta Hutzel's work, that shows that 8 weeks of MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction training, can actually change the thickness of particular regions of interest in the brain, both in the cortex and insula, in the areas of the limbic system like the hippocampus, which is involved in learning and memory, in 8 weeks. those are really pretty amazing that you can change your brain that much in that way. And the amygdala, which is our kind of threat arousal center, actually thins during those 8 weeks. So that is in some sense a suggestion, not proof, but a suggestion that if you actually practice cultivating awareness in this kind of systematic way over time, in 8 weeks, you can change the way your brain actually regulates and sort of modulates your relationship to the interiority of your own experience and to the outside world.
We were talking in the last hour with Michael Lerner about changing consciousness. And to some extent, when you talk about being within the now, I mean, it gets back to things like Gestalt psychology and all that. How do you get within the moment? How do you remove yourself from thinking and obsessing, as so many people do, about the past and the future, but just being within this authentic moment that we're in right now?
There's a one-word answer to that. You practice. It's as simple as that. Just the way you, if you want your bicep to be bigger, you work with the resistance that a weight will provide. You work with your own resistance, your own lack of motivation on certain days, with your own sort of fatigue and confusion and tension and anxiety. And instead of turning away from them, you turn towards them, put the welcome mat out, and befriend them. And in a way, that frees you instantly from that kind of burden that then does accumulate over days, weeks, and months.
You've been associated in many ways with Buddhist thinking for a number of years now. And in fact, a lot of mindfulness certainly goes back to Buddhist thinking. And it's becoming increasingly clear to many of us that American thinking, some version of American thinking, is trying to sort of unite East and West, as Kipling said, never the twain, but bring a kind of American Buddhism and bring the Dharma here, as it were.
Yeah.
The whole notion of many of the tenets of Buddhism. Is it quite possible? I remember, it's a funny name to evoke, but I remember many years ago, Ken Kesey said to me, they're too irreconcilable. You know, again, East is East and West
Jung,
is West.
Jung thought the same, and he was a student of Zen and, you know, the I Ching and so forth. You know, even the terminology East and West, if you go back to, you know, the local hero, Alan Watts here, you know, East and West, he wrote a book called Psychotherapy, East and West. That seems like the Stone Age from my perspective. No one talks about East and West anymore. We have this sense that the planet is one whole, and what's East in the morning is West in the evening. And you know, I just came back from 10 days of teaching in China. And in some sense, we are more in touch with the – you use the word Dharma here in the United States than they are in China, where they have a 1,500-year history of it. And part of my reason for going was to remind them of their 1,500-year history of it and point out what kind of research is going on here around it. Because imagine what would happen if the Chinese got back in touch with their 4,000-year history of Taoism and 1,500-year history of Dharma. And I'm not talking about Buddhism. I'm talking about the sort of universal aspects of understanding the human nature, so to speak, and then acting on that basis in terms of economics and politics. That would have a fairly sizable impact on the way things are going to unfold in the future. So this is East and West is kind of a really old and I think very stereotyped sort of a vocabulary at this point in time. And the way I prefer to think of it is as human, simply human.
And global.
And totally global. And we're talking about the nature of mind, the nature of the heart, and the nature of the body, and the nature of human relationship. And it's all woven into one seamless whole that then thinking dissects. And our thinking is we're very masterful thinkers. But to come back to what you were saying about Buddhist thought, mindfulness is usually spoken of as the heart of Buddhist meditation. And in all Asian languages, the word for mind and the word for heart, the same word. So when you hear the word mindfulness, if you're not hearing heartfulness, you're not really understanding it. It's not like, oh, then we'll sprinkle on compassion, or we'll sprinkle on kindness, or we'll sprinkle on equanimity. These things are folded into the DNA, so to speak, of this quality of awareness.
The Western may be a Stone Age word in contradistinction from Eastern, but there is a sense in the West that the heart and the and the head are divided.
Yes, of course. Yeah, and it's true. We export that too. So it's true virtually everywhere.
And when people talk about Westernization, they're talking about that materialism or that division between
very
heart and head.
So.
Also brings me to since you were talking about the science of things before, what do we actually know? We kind of accept this holistic health notion, and it's become almost proverbial in its acceptance. And the idea that mind and body are unified. What do we actually know about the effect of such things as meditation on, well, the immune system? Because we hear a lot about this.
Well, you know, this has been my work for the past 30-plus years and the work of my colleagues doing mindfulness-based stress reduction now all around the world and also mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Nancy Bardicke here in, you know, UCSF is doing mindfulness-based childbirth and parenting and science at the Ocean Center to investigate the effects of this.
And there's been a lot of work. I mean, Danny Goleman's been on here talking about the work with the Dalai Lama and so forth. But there are those who, I suppose, remain outside of the acceptance entirely of all of this.
Well, that's fine. You know, the bell curve of the society doesn't just take some gigantic quantum leap all at once. It shifts very slowly and inexorably as, you know, people come to understand certain profound insights that actually are world-shifting and transformational, and there are a lot of them here. So just to answer your question, I did a study a number of years ago in collaboration with Richie Davidson at the University of Wisconsin, the Laboratory of Affective Neuroscience, and his colleagues, showing that people in a high-stress biotech company who were trained in mindfulness-based stress reduction or a weightless control that was randomized so that everybody was the same when they started out, that the people in the MBSR condition had a dramatic shift from more right activation to left activation in certain regions of the prefrontal cortex of the brain that 30 years of his research have showed is involved in actually a great shift to more emotionally intelligent decoding of stressful emotional situations. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we gave people in that study a flu vaccine at the end of the 8 weeks of MBSR training and then followed their antibody titers in the blood up to 10 weeks later and found that the meditators mounted a significantly stronger immune response than the non-meditating weightless control to the flu vaccine, and that if you plotted the degree of brain shift versus the degree of antibody in the blood, the higher the shift from right to left in the brain, the higher the immune response. So this is, again, just science in its infancy around meditation, but it's an example of what you were talking about, the mind-body connection, and the fact that when you start to pay attention in this way, your material body, your brain, your synapses, your immune system, your autonomic nervous system, the heart, the lungs, the liver, they all come online in a particular way.
Again, we're talking with Jon Kabat-Zinn, and his new book is Mindfulness for Beginners, Reclaiming the Present Moment and Your Life. And let me give you a phone number to call. If you'd like to join us, we welcome you becoming a part of this conversation with any questions or comments you might have. Our toll-free number is available now. 866-733-6786 is the number for you to call. Again, that's 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or post your questions or your comments on our website by simply going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Or go to our Facebook page, and you can put questions or comments there. And when we return, we'll hear from you. Again, our guest is Jon Kabat-Zinn. His book, Mindfulness for Beginners. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Jon Kabat-Zinn, author of Mindfulness for Beginners. And actually, he'll be speaking at a benefit for Oakland-based nonprofit Mindful Schools on the 17th of February, and that's my anniversary, isn't it? Being on the radio here at KQED. It's at Zellerbach Hall in Berkeley, and you can visit mindfulschools.org for more information. Some of you are visiting us here by email. Mark in San Francisco says, I'm here in my workshop scraping old glue out of piano parts for a rebuilding job while listening to Forum. Does Mr. Kabat-Zinn feel that this radio distraction, which I often use for mundane jobs, detracts from mindfulness and encourages scattered thoughts?
Doesn't matter what I think. What's your experience of it? It doesn't have to. The world is quite complex, and so we can attend to a sort of range of things coming into our experience. But a lot of the time we use it to self-distract as opposed to attend. So maybe you should now just shut off your radio and go back to scraping that piano with
Don't tell them to shut off the radio.
100% attention.
You want to give 100% attention to this program. That's what we want. That's what we want.
That's advanced. That's an advanced state of mind.
Well, it's people talk a lot about multitasking.
Yes, they do.
That's become one of those words.
And a lot of the science is showing that multitasking is impossible, that every performance—
Your mind scatters, yeah.
Every performance indicator, when it's tested, goes down. So you can think, wow, I'm doing so great juggling all these balls, but actually each ball is getting less attention than it needs to be optimal.
Listener named Susan says, do you see any differences between men and women in the success of meditation? Is it true or simply popular thought that men are better at compartmentalizing and finding the empty space easier to locate and embody?
Wow. I don't know. I doubt it. I've never seen any major indicators that that's the case. I think a lot of it is temperamental. But again, it's something that can be worked with. The more aware you are of how scattered you are, the less scattered you'll be. So this is something where every aspect of what comes up that you might think of as an obstacle can actually become an ally in your cultivating a greater sense of well-being and presence.
And we'll bring our callers in. We go first to Peter. Hi, you're on.
Hi, my name's Peter Newsom. I'm a psychiatrist in Menlo Park, and our practice we call Mindfulness-Centered Healing. I've been a huge fan of yours, John, for many years since I met you, I think 40 years ago in Massachusetts.
Well, nice to meet you on the radio.
I first started learning about the mindfulness work then, and then I gradually got part of a tradition called the Gurdjieff work. And, you know, the wonderful thing I've studied is in the fact that there's mindfulness parts of all the world's great religions, and specifically, there's big mindfulness parts of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam.
Absolutely.
And Gurdjieff tried to say that, you know, the mindfulness parts of those three great religions are in total agreement, as opposed to the fundamentalist parts of those religions. And couldn't mindfulness become a source of tremendous healing in the world, sort of in the religious sphere? I'll take my
Thank you for that. I think Gurdjieff believed that. I mean, he believed there was actually a birth above the body that could be, you know, that could take place. So he's a mystic, essentially. Yeah.
Well, in my book that you mentioned, Coming to Our Senses, the subtitle is Healing Ourselves and the World Through Mindfulness. So I do feel like awareness, if you will, is the final common pathway of what makes us human. And while we can always find reasons to fight or argue over differences, especially when we fall into a kind of fundamentalist viewpoint where in order for me to be right, you have to be wrong, which is very, very dualistic, that if we could actually attend to what we have in common and then really celebrate the differences and argue about them, if you will, without killing each other, you know, this is a deep, deep tradition in Western civilization and democracy, but it's been, you know, in some sense overshadowed by how seriously we take these issues and then draw lines in the sand and go to war over them. And then we remember that, oh, yeah, we don't even know why we're going to war, but a lot of people have been killed in the process.
I was going to think, when you said overshadowed, I was thinking of Jung again. I mean, it is sort of the shadow self that rears its ugly head or whatever. But you talk in your book about—
And shadows disappear in the light. So when we start to pay attention, then a lot of that shadow stuff becomes actually grist for the mill. It becomes useful as opposed to something we want to keep walled off.
You talk about differences between healing and curing. And I mean, even on a global sense, there really is an important distinction here, isn't there?
Very. We spoke earlier about not thinking of mindfulness or enlightenment as some kind of special state that when I get that, my brain will be different. I'll be much more this. I'll be much more that. So I'm no good now. But if I really work this muscle of mindfulness or meditate and move to a cave in India or something like that, I'll become enlightened, then I'll be okay. The fact of the matter is if you're not okay now, you're never going to be okay. And this is the real message of all these contemplative traditions is that you start where you are and you recognize that who you think you are is not all of who you are. And the part that usually gets ignored is the heart and this quality of awareness. And when we begin to learn how to dwell inside that space, to inhabit that space of the heart and the mind, then the body changes, the brain changes, our relationships change, but without you having to do anything. So medicine is kind of like a very much a fixing model. It's like an auto mechanics model of the body and the mind, and it's just really old-fashioned, and even the science doesn't support it. But healing, in my terminology, is perceiving things as they are, coming to terms, if you will, with things as they are. So as soon as you shift, rotate in consciousness, even that little bit, then the body has its ear to the rail and things start to change in the body. Your relationship to pain, to discomfort, to depressive rumination, to heart palpitations, to cancer, to all sorts of things. You can change your relationship to it and thereby actually transform how things will unfold at the level of the body. That doesn't mean that you're going to meditate your cancer away or something.
Or it doesn't mean the pain is going to stop.
Or the pain will necessarily stop, but your relationship to it will change in some way that there'll be an element of freedom, or what you could call a new dimension of freedom that is profoundly satisfying and healing and healthy, so that even if we are going to die, and as far as I know, we're still all going to die, although people are working hard to, you know, make sure that comes to an end at some point with the senescence genes and telomerase and so forth. But for now, it's really not about dying. It's about living fully the moments that are ours to live.
And as I was going to add, contingent upon, my old friend Ramdas, you say, being here now and being within the moment.
Where else could you be?
Let's go to – well, we can give one or more calls. Let's do that. We'll go next to David. You're on. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I have two questions, but I'll see if I can get past my first one. First of all, when I try to meditate, I just can't get past two things, or both, one or either. One is sort of the monkey chatter, which is just really not very nice to listen to, and also not nice to listen to is just the negative thoughts I have about myself. So there are like two disincentives to meditate.
Welcome to the club, okay? And I'm sure your listeners everywhere in the area are smiling. So yeah, that could seem like a huge impediment, especially if you feel, and you use these words, I have to get past it. So that's kind of the suggestion that this is an impediment to the cultivation of
calmness, awareness,
clarity.
Or I've got to be a great meditator. If I'm going to be a meditator, I've got to be the best meditator.
I'm going to be the best meditator I can be. And the best way to do that is to get out of your own way. And that thought process is actually detrimental to being in the present moment. So here's what you could try is just allowing yourself to sit down and open to whatever is prominent in the field of your experience. And if it's chatter, monkey mind, as you called it, just let it be there. And think of it, if you will, to use an image, think of it as a kind of waterfall, and it's just going to keep going, and, you know, in Yosemite or someplace like that. And your job is to just be present and hear it, or a brook gurgling. And it's not like you have to change it or understand it or reroute it or anything like that, but to just be in its presence. When you are willing to sit in that way with a certain degree of patience and resolve, that is the practice. It's not like something else will happen and then you'll get where you're supposed to be. There's no special mindful state. What mindfulness is and the embrace of whatever your experience is in the moment. And the irony is when you embrace it, your relationship to that chatter is going to change. Your insight into some of, you know, what's going on in your thinking and in your emotions will change. And therefore, your ability to actually navigate that, since it's going on morning, noon, and night in your life, will actually affect the quality of your life and your relationships in ways that I couldn't begin to describe to you. But you can adventure in that field all by yourself and then give up the thought, which is totally inaccurate. I'm one of those people who just can't meditate because I can't concentrate and I can't shut down my mind, when it has nothing to do with shutting down your mind. That'll just give you a gigantic headache.
But you can get to different levels of consciousness. There's been too much testimony about this. You can get to higher levels of consciousness. You can get to not even necessarily enlightenment or Sartori or anything like that, but you can get to I remember one of the first guys who was trying to sell me on TM said the charming levels of consciousness was the word that he used, which seemed to me a little off-putting. But the fact is that there are many people who use meditation. In fact, Jack Kornfield wrote a book called After the Ecstasy of the Laundry, you know, that you can get to a kind of ecstatic state.
Every in-breath is an ecstatic state. Just try not taking it for long enough. So there's a certain way in that in which that kind of language and that kind of thinking and promulgating those kinds of things by many people about, you know, and then it edges into mysticism and special mystical states and giving the idea that there's some special magical thing that's going to happen if you just keep following your breath. And that is actually really, I think, a form of violence, harmful in a certain way, because it's creating this ideal that actually then we separates us from some ideal and then we strive to reach that ideal. It's completely contradictory to all the wisdom traditions.
No, but understand what I'm saying. With enough practice and with enough of being assiduous about the practice, people have said that they have gone to those levels.
I understand that.
But it's a magnet to those who think they can do it quickly.
You know, talking about be here now, that ecstasy is not any further away than this moment. And the laundry is no further away either. So the point is that we can create these idealistic dualisms, and it sounds wonderful and it sells books, but it actually confuses more people than it enlightens, if you don't mind my putting it that way.
Don't mind you putting it that way at all. Let's go to more of our callers. And Joseph, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Thank you. Mr. Zen, thank you. Your work is important and helpful.
Thank you.
I've got a question. You know, I've been through some anxiety issues, and I've been to doctors, and we all know they're quick to prescribe medication. So my question is, and I like to think that the doctors I've seen are intelligent people and, you know, well-read, and I just want to know, are there any or are there not any definitive studies out there that suggests that meditation does work for anxiety and depression? Because if there are studies that suggest that and that can prove that, why are we still heavily, you know, relying on medication? Thanks.
Okay. Well, what a beautiful question and beautifully framed. And I'll actually start by quoting a quantum physicist, Max Planck, who said of physics, where it's all in the equations, in the mathematics, and so you don't have any kind of attachment to, you know, emotion, if you will, or shouldn't, that physics progresses funeral by funeral. And he meant funerals of physicists. So, yes, of course, physicians are intelligent and they're extremely well-meaning and, well, you know, good-hearted, but everybody does what it is that they know how to do. And so to answer your study about your question about studies of the effects of mindfulness on anxiety and depression, a book just came out called Mindfulness, The Mindful Way Through Anxiety. I wrote a book with several people called The Mindful Way Through Depression. There's a whole field called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy now, which is actually mandated in the UK Public Health Service for people who have had three or more episodes of major depressive disorder. So if you kind of just Google mindfulness and anxiety or mindfulness and depression, you're going to find all sorts of things, including very reputable scientific studies that are suggesting that you can responsibly, in collaboration with your doctor or your psychiatrist, you can actually titrate down the medication and titrate up the meditation. It's a switch of one consonant, but can make a huge difference in your life.
Actually, you mentioned Google, and I happen to see the talk you gave here in San Francisco to Google, and you use the analogy of meditation as being like the orchestra tuning up. They wouldn't play Beethoven without tuning up, and that's what you should do when you meditate. I mean, you're essentially tuning up.
That's what meditation is. Well, I was suggesting it in terms of, like, people say, well, when should I meditate? Did you meditate this morning? Well, the real answer to that question, I mean, if you were to ask that to me, is when are you not meditating? If it's about being present from moment to moment in an open, spacious, non-reactive, non-judgmental way, then taking the BART is a meditation. Walking down the street is a meditation. Eating lunch is a meditation. Walking in the door and greeting your children is a meditation. Do you hear what I'm saying?
So I hear exactly what you're saying.
It's not just sitting cross-legged on the cushion.
But most people do identify it with that time alone when you're giving
yourself
up to that.
That's why I'm on your show.
So forth. Yes, I understand
that. To disabuse people of that sort of very narrow
notion. But you did a whole stress reduction program. I believe you were doing essentially a couple hours of classes and one all day long and so forth. I mean, there was actually
That's what MBSR is. I mean, it's a formal curriculum for training medical patients.
But you don't necessarily advise people to do it formally in their own life?
Oh, no. I'm not saying that people shouldn't do it formally. I'm saying that the real meditation is how you live your life from moment to moment. And people will find lots of different ways to do it. So some will do it through the yoga door, the mindful yoga door. Others will do it through sitting meditation. Others may do it through lying down meditations, body scans. Other people will do it through chopping vegetables. Other people will do it by, if they're a school teacher, being aware of each one of their children in the classroom when they walk into the room in the morning. There are lots of different ways
to cultivate mindfulness. There's a ritual to this. There's a ritualistic side of this.
Well, dropping into the present moment is the ultimate ritual.
Yeah. I mean, I can think of, like, when I take out the garbage, I think,
exactly. We assign that as a form of meditation to our patients. Take out the garbage mindfully.
But I also think of what I learned from studying karate, which is a real sense of being within the moment that there's nothing
martial
like.
Arts were martial arts or meditation?
For me were the best.
Me too.
Here's Terry who writes, I have two questions for Jon Kabat-Zinn. First, I'm reading Mindfulness in Plain English by Sri Lankan Monk, a book endorsed by Mr. Kabat-Zinn. It describes vipassana, meditation, cultivating awareness versus exclusively concentrating or relaxing. How does Zen practice differ? And second, how does one reconcile the practice of detachment from the value of cultivating love and kindness? Don't these sentiments assume attachment? Isn't grief, too, the outcome of deep love?
Well, that's asking an awful lot there. You know.
There's a lot packed in there, to use your phrase
there
again.
Is. Yeah. So the first thing I would say is that you asked about Zen and Vipassana. To a first approximation, let's say they're all different doors into the same room. Every doorway looks different. It has its own geometry and its geography. But the important thing is to enter into the room, not stand in the doorway and say how great your doorway is versus somebody else's. I met a whole bunch of Chan monks in China last month who go to Burma every year and sit for 5 months because they feel there's a certain kind of energy in the Burmese Vipassana tradition that's kind of died out in China. And it was a big surprise to me because I think that a lot of the Chinese energy that they are looking for is actually over here in the U.S. now. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of global cross-fertilization. They were totally into MBSR and actually had read the paper and understood what it was. So that's part of it. And the other thing is that, there's – the question was so complicated. Give me the last little piece
of it. Well, the question had
it.
To do with attachment. You know, there's a lot – and a lot of this often comes up with Buddhism. I mean, if you're cultivating love and kindness, how does it reconcile with detachment as opposed to attachment? And then this listener says, isn't grief, too, the outcome of deep love? And,
yes, of course grief is the outcome of love. And there's nothing wrong with grief or, for that matter, any other emotion. It's how we hold it that makes all the difference. And so, first of all, I'd just like to say that we're not, as far as I know, talking about Buddhism here. What we're talking about is the Dharma. We're talking about some kind of universal understanding of the value of the human heart. Heart and the human mind when it knows itself. And there are many, many different ways to cultivate it. And so, as I was suggesting earlier, loving kindness and compassion are built right into just taking your seat in the morning to follow your breath, to sit for a moment, to go from doing to a few moments of being in the morning, the kind of tuning of the instrument or the orchestra we were talking about. That's a radical act of love. And sanity, just to take a moment and be yourself without having to be different, to improve, to be better. But just for yourself is a gigantic gift to yourself. And then if there's grief present, then put the welcome mat out for grief. There's a beautiful poem by Naomi Shihab Nye that has the line in it that says, before you know kindness is the deepest thing inside, before you know kindness is the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth.
Yeah,
now, when we see the size of the cloth, then this dropping in on the present moment is, in fact, a radical act of love. And it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with grief. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with anger. But anger, if it's not met with awareness, can get very toxic towards yourself and towards other people. You know, a lot of people, or experienced a lot of people in prison who had one, you know, sort of unaware impulse, and they wind up in jail for the rest of their lives.
More of our callers. We'll go to Penny next. Penny, you're on.
Yes, hello. I came out of the 60s, quote-unquote, here in Haight-Ashbury, and I remember we took very large doses of LSD and concentrating on being in the here and the now and getting away from a dualistic vision of the universe into a universalistic picture of it.
Yep.
And I just wonder, I swear that it changed my consciousness tremendously, that it broadened my horizons and opened up my mind and altered my consciousness in a way that has resulted in my looking younger, feeling younger, being healthier and happier. And I just wonder what you, Dr.
Penny, is this a personal endorsement for LSD?
Oh, well, it's sure. Yeah. What's the question? You know, is that what does your guest think about that?
Well, let's find
out. A lot of it.
You know, there's a whole field of serious people, scientists and physicians, who actually are now, not like in the 60s, looking into these questions and the effects of various kinds of psychoactive drugs and medications on life, on the brain.
Excuse me, but experience. With the death of Steve Jobs, there was a lot of, because he's said on a number of occasions that one of the most transfiguring experiences in his life was taking LSD.
Exactly, and many people, of course, have said that. So the important thing is, you know, if that illuminated some possibilities for you about your own life and your own understanding of your relationship with nature, with the world, with the sky, with whatever it is, with the dark, with the light, how do you live that in your daily life from moment to moment?
And I thank the caller. Let me go to some of your emails here. Charlie says, I'm a recovering alcoholic who practices mindfulness and medication. I think he means maybe meditation as part of my AA recovery program. It has been a wonderful experience that has allowed me to grow spiritually, excuse me, over the past 3 years. However, I find that I still have problems staying in the moment free of anger when my wireless printer decides not to work as designed.
Oh, yeah, that's advanced training. That's like beyond graduate school. You know, we get very, very attached to this, our digital devices, and so they become great teachers. I mean, and you're seeing how easily we can be frustrated, say, if our email breaks down or if, you know, something doesn't work in one way or another, your printer doesn't work. So then your printer becomes your mindfulness teacher, and you need to bow to it and offer loving kindness to yourself for the experience.
Did an evening with a couple of leading Buddhist thinkers at Zellerbach, in fact, a few years ago, and all the electricity went out. And as a result, it was pretty clear that some people who had seats that were assigned and so forth were not going to get those seats, and it caused some consternation and everything. And Jack Kornfield was there, and one of the first things he said was, this is a real lesson in mindfulness, you know, instead of letting ourselves just go.
And it happened in Candlestick Park last night.
Yeah, there was an outage in Candlestick last night.
Yeah, right? Twice.
Right?
Twice. During the football game.
Yeah, one of my friends back east says, why can't things go right in San Francisco? I said, come on. Lots of things go right in San Francisco. Here's Craig, who writes, I've read Full Catastrophe Living twice. It helped me work with anxiety attacks. I've since passed your book on to my father-in-law, who was recently diagnosed with cancer and having anxiety attacks. Healing takes time and practice, and even after meditating twice a day with your tapes, it still took several months to self-regulate, not just 8 weeks, but relief exists and a lifelong practice was born.
Well, thank you.
Some more emails. Here's Casty, who says, excuse me, I've always had a conflict with Eastern approaches to the self, which seem to view the self and everything else as illusion. It's almost like modern materialists that say that the mind is just metaphenomena of the brain, nothing more. How can I use meditation if I spiritually value the self or soul as real and as something that is important to be attached to?
Well, one way you can do it is to just look at all of what you've just said as thinking. And it can be...
And it's illusion.
You know, and so it's merely thought. And instead, see if you can play with letting it just do its thing, whatever your ideas and opinions and attachments and, you know, and the things that you like and dislike. And instead, just see if you can hold all of that like a mother might hold her child, you know, with awareness, with kindness, and just let it teach you what it needs to teach you as opposed to trying to figure it all out with your thinking mind, which you will never do.
Lee from Palo Alto says, I judge spiritual disciplines by the degree to which they incorporate a sense of humor. The less humor, the more false. Thus, my favorite Zen koan about contemplation is the one about the seeker after truth who asks a sage how long it will take him to reach enlightenment. The sage promptly answers, 5 years. The seeker says, no, you don't understand. I'm willing to work really, really hard at it. And the sage replies, well, in that case, 10.
Yeah, I love that koan too.
Here's Laura from Richmond who says, could you say a little bit more about what you mean when you talk about the heart, empathy, compassion, love? If you met a heart that was awakened and full, how would you know it?
I mean, you know, have you ever looked in a baby's eyes? Have you ever been in love? Have you ever walked down the street and, you know, connected with somebody in that moment without any ulterior motive? Have you ever gazed at a flower? Have you ever looked at a sunset? I mean, it's everywhere. And I don't know how we know it, but it's built into us that we do know it. And yet we ignore it and self-distract and carry ours and fall
ignore
into
it at our peril, I think.
And we ignore it and it causes us suffering, yeah.
So any hints on, before we conclude here, being in the here and now from your perspective, Jon Kabat-Zinn's perspective?
Well, no.
I mean, you've just kind of given some of them.
Of course. I mean, the entire program has been about that. I would say trust your own instincts and creativity. And if anything that has touched you, you know, tickled your auditory nerves during this hour, then trust it and let life itself become the teacher and let each of your moments be a new beginning. And let go if you can, or practice letting go of the things that seem to grab you and, you know, bring you down. And just notice that they are, for the most part, constructs of the thinking process, and that if you see them as such, the next moment presents new openings and possibilities that just didn't exist the moment before, right inside yourself and your own experience.
On that note, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate the hour.
My pleasure, Michael.
Jon Kabat-Zinn, and again, his book is Mindfulness for Beginners, Reclaiming the Present Moment in Your Life. He'll be at Zellerbach February 17th as a benefit for the Oakland-based nonprofit Mindful Schools. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Let's thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Amy Machado. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.